Jeez, I'll look. Okay.
Then. Utajam. The Hermitage. Upayatam. Approached. Nidevam. The monarch. Pranatam. Bowed down. Puraha. In front. Saparyaya. With honor. Parya grinnat. Received him. Pratinandya. Greeting him. Anurupaya. Befitting the king's position. The translation. Seeing that the monarch had come to his hermitage and was bowing before him, the sage greeted him with benediction and received him with due honor. So purport by His Divine Grace, Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Emperor Swayambhuva Manu not only approached the cottage of dried leaves possessed by the hermit Kardama, but also offered respectful obeisances unto him. Similarly, it was the duty of the hermit to offer blessings to kings who used to approach his hermitage in the jungle. Atottajam upayatam ridevam pranatam puraha saparyaya parya grinhat patinan janu rupaiha. Om gadat shivananda shah gananjana shalakaya chakshur unmiritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So here you see an exhibition of something called the Varnashram culture. And we know Srila Prabhupada stated that 50% of his work was undone because he had not instituted Varnashram. So we should try to understand what that means, the institution of Varnashram. And as we were presenting this seminar in Suva about Prabhupada's, let's say, exposition of the philosophy and the practical execution of the philosophy, we saw that Prabhupada's preaching, in one sense, changed as far as the how to execute the philosophy of Krishna consciousness throughout his pastimes, his tenure after he came to America. Of course, the first aspect of the preaching was that everybody should actually move into the temple. And if you weren't living in the temple, you were in Maya. That was the first aspect of the preaching. And I remember in the early days it was like that, that as soon as someone moved out of the temple, even to get married, they were considered to have blooped from the Krishna consciousness moment. I mean, so even we had grihasthas living with their kids in the temple in very austere conditions. I remember in Dallas, Texas, in the early days, we had 35 people living in the temple, men and women, grihasthas, sharing one bathroom. One bathroom, men, women, and children. And we also had a school. You know, there were five children. I was actually the teacher. Yeah, see, I was a teacher before you were born. I was actually a teacher with five children that I had to take care of. Five little boys, 5 years old, that had been separated from their mothers. And I had to take care of them 24 hours a day. And I had to get them to Mangalarti every morning, in spite of everybody else using the same bathroom every morning, men and women. So it was just like marching the kids in, and you know how the kids were kind of tired in the morning. You know, kids can be tired at like 3:30 in the morning. So marching the kids in and basically carrying them into the shower and turning the water on and washing them and then putting them in their little dhotis. And then the householders with their wives and whatever children, they were all living in this one building. In fact, it was so austere that at night you couldn't really, if you were in your sleeping bag, because we didn't have beds in those days, if you were in your sleeping bag, if you rolled over, you couldn't roll over because you would commit Vaishnava aparada by hitting some other Vaishnava. In other words, it was such tight facility, the sleeping bags were right next to each other, so you had to go like that all night long. Because you never knew who you were going to wake up next to in the morning. You know, whether it was a sannyasi or whatever it was. Of course, the men and women, they slept in separate rooms, obviously. So that was one thing. But so Prabhupada's preaching was that, you know, everybody basically had to live in the temple. That's the first stage. And then after that, Prabhupada instituted the congregational preaching. I remember we were shocked. I was in Dallas, Texas also, because I spent a lot of time in Dallas, Texas in the early days. I was shocked when Prabhupada gave initiation to people who were not living in the temple. We were all shocked. It was just like, you know, this couple came with their children from some other place, and Prabhupada was there. It was in Dallas, Texas, 1972, I think, or 73. So they came from another city, and they had been chanting Hare Krishna, following the four regulative principles, and Prabhupada initiated them. And everyone was saying, how is this possible? They're initiated devotees and they're living in their home? It was a shock. Can you imagine that? You know, if we made a requirement that everybody who took initiation had to be living in the temple, it would be, anyway, be kind of funny. And a lot of the people who lived in the temples in those days were pretty crazy. And it was, you know, you talk about problems now. You know, we had Mayavadis living in the temple, you know, people who did all sorts of crazy things in the temple. You just didn't know whether your stuff would get stolen in the middle of the night. It was pretty intense. Or you'd wake up in the morning and someone would be coming off of a drug trip. You know, so devotees were very liberal, so they would, like if someone was on LSD or something like that, hallucinating, they would invite them into the temple. Why don't you spend a night here? So you wake up in the morning and there'd just be this guy with the pupils that are dilated, you know what I'm saying? Dilated pupils. You know, the pupils are the center portion of the eyes, and it'll be all black, the eyes. That's a sign when one is taking drugs. So you wake up and these, and people would be, you know, you have people in Bhagavatam class telling you they were God. They'd ask the question, am I really God? It was an interesting time in the Krishna consciousness movement. So anyway, getting back to the point, the second stage was when people started taking initiation, congregation members. And then the third stage was, which Prabhupada didn't get a chance to institute completely, was Varnashram. Now, you may ask, you know, why would Prabhupada stressing on Varnashram? Because we find in the discussion between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy, it's called the Ramananda Sambhada, with the instructions, where Ramananda Roy took the position of the teacher, and Lord Chaitanya took the position of the student. He was questioning Ramananda Roy. This happened along the banks of the Godavari River in Vijayanagara, when Lord Chaitanya was touring South India. You find when Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy, you know, what is the purpose of life and what is the goal? And Ramananda Roy talked about Varnashram, and Lord Chaitanya rejected it completely. He said it's simply external. I mean, he rejected a lot of other things too. Even karma misra bhakti or jnana misra bhakti, he rejected in that whole discussion. That means bhakti mixed with a desire for fruit of gain or material sense gratification, or a bhakti mixed with a desire for liberation. That's jnana misra bhakti. So the first thing Lord Chaitanya rejected was Varnashram. And so then Prabhupada commented, he said Lord Chaitanya was nirupeksha. That means he was disinterested in this world. And Prabhupada said, we are interested in this world for Krishna, not for sense gratification, but we are interested in engaging everything in this world because Prabhupada wanted a mission that would engage the whole world in Krishna consciousness. So basically, Prabhupada took it as part of his preaching strategy and also as a means to save the devotees from falling down completely. Because unless you have a social structure means you have social rituals and different things like that. Like we have a lot of rituals in Krishna consciousness that really are not the essence of Krishna consciousness. they're secondary principles. I mean, for example, and I've mentioned this before, we have dhotis. Dhotis are not the essence of Krishna consciousness. It's a ritual. You know, the dress is a ritual. I mean, I hate to say that. And you see, it's actually relative. It's a relative ritual because you see different parts of India, they wear dhotis differently. And different parts of India, they have different types of sikhas, right? Like in South India, they'll have a sikha like this wide. And different parts of India, they have different types of tilak. Like the South Indian tilak, you know, is very wide here. And even in our sampradaya, sometimes you have this reddish tilak that certain devotees wear. Anyway, so these things are external. The real essence of Krishna consciousness is Nam Kirtan, you know, chanting the holy names. Kali Kulera Dharma, Krishna Dharma Sankirtan. As stated in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. However, because not everybody is able to stick very closely or tightly with the rules and regulations of Krishna consciousness, it means getting up early, eating only prasad. And as you see, like Prabhupada gave this whole list in the first temple about different things. And even he said, one time he said, you know, devotees don't read newspapers. You know, the Prabhupada was very strong about this. And, I mean, of course, Prabhupada sometimes, he did read a newspaper, but just to find out how to serve Krishna. Not that he read, like you have in your Fiji Times or Fiji Sun, most of it's the sports section or the Bollywood section. Someone gave me the newspaper the other day, and they opened it up, and there was this whole Bollywood section with pictures of half-naked women in it. And I said, what's this use of this thing? Just a waste of paper. So Prabhupada was very, or Prabhupada said food, devotees don't eat food cooked by non-devotees, right? So, I mean, there's so many rules Prabhupada posted on the wall of the original temple in 26 Second Avenue. So Prabhupada had high expectations for us. However, most of the devotees that Prabhupada initiated didn't really stick to those same standards. So when you have people who won't stick to the high standards of Krishna consciousness, you need some sort of culture to keep them, let's say, from falling down completely, or as I say sometimes, becoming hippies again. Like Prabhupada was fond of mentioning that story about Punarmushika Bhava, you know, again become a mouse. I'm not going to tell that story. Or Prabhupada even considered, Prabhupada was so strong in the early days that if someone started growing hair, he would call it hippie seeds. Can you imagine that? Like if someone had more than 2 weeks of growth of hair, I'm not going to look around here. Not just the men, not the women. Prabhupada would call it, why you have those hippie seeds? Because Prabhupada was very concerned. So the point I'm making is that, therefore, to keep people from falling down completely to what they were before, and to keep people still executing devotional service, even though they can't be very strict in, like, avoiding the cinema. I mean, many times in Suva, for example, if we want to see the devotees, we go to Village 6 or Village 7, and there's more devotees there than at Mangalarti in the morning. You know, I was telling Goku, we could have like a Harinam at Village 6. And then, anyway, so the point I'm making is that most people don't really stick to the really strict standards of Krishna consciousness. And we have to be honest. I mean, as much as we'd like to say that everybody who sits down and takes initiation is going to chant 16 rounds, follow the four regulative principles, not eat food cooked by non-devotees. I mean, there's a reason for that. Prabhupada said if you eat food cooked by those who are not Krishna conscious, your mind becomes wicked. It's a fact. If you eat at restaurants, what do you think is going to happen? Or if you listen to mundane music. But my experience is, you know, you just can't stop everybody from doing these things. As much as I'd like to discipline all my disciples, it doesn't work. I mean, I have one disciple who chants her rounds watching Bollywood movies. And I can't stop her. Isn't that Goku? It's not Goku, don't worry. It's someone who he knows. And it's just like, huh? So you just wonder, you know, what's happening? You know, you had such a nice smiling face when you were taking initiation and taking the beads from me, and you said, Jai Gurudev, I'll do whatever you want. Won't commit any of the offenses I'm chanting, and won't disobey the order of the spiritual master. You know, everything was just like high expectations. But then what happened? And then this is the world. Like when the first devotee blooped from the movement, Prabhupada cried because he couldn't believe it. Because Prabhupada was brought up in a high-class culture. And a high-class culture, someone keeps makes a promise, they keep it. It's just like Grandfather Bhishma made a promise, kept it. Right? Prabhupada made a promise, kept it. But Prabhupada didn't expect what he came across outside of his culture. I mean, not only in the West, but also in India. You find the same thing. And in Fiji, you know, in Fiji I'm finding the same thing I find in America. I hate to say it. You know, when I first came to Fiji, I thought, well, everything's perfect. Prasadam's perfect. Everything's tasty. And then Srila Tamalakrishnamurti said, yeah, the politics are tasty. I didn't believe him until I had the realization about it, until I saw it. And then, you know, and I thought, well, everybody's smiling here in Fiji. They're so dharmic. They're from India. They must be like Vrajavasi. You know, I thought everybody here was a Vrajavasi when I first came. That was like going to Vrindavan. Then I discovered it wasn't like that. That people really were just like everybody else in the West. I mean, it's really no different as far as people. I mean, sometimes a small minority of people, because minority means small, a minority of people, you will find people who are very strict and stick to it and are Brahminical. However, the majority, no. So therefore, Prabhupada had to be practical, and then he talked about Varnashram. Varnashram is a strategy to engage the whole world, and Varnashram also is a strategy to keep his disciples from going, becoming hippies again. So there was two aspects to that Varnashram. So Varnashram means there's certain types of behavior that are mentioned here in this particular verse and purport that are prescribed for people in different varnas and people in different ashrams. I mean, for example, we have Emperor Swayambhuva Manu offering obeisances, you know, dandavats, and we have the Kardama offering blessings. I mean, so this is, and then within each of the ashrams, there's also prescribed methods of making a living. Within the varnas, there's a prescribed method of making a living, like the brahmanas, yajan, yajan, patan, patan, dana pratigraha. They make a living, support their family because people give them donations. They perform sacrifices, get donations from that. They give instructions, and people give them donations from that. And they also give away donations themselves. And not that they keep money. A Brahmin doesn't, someone who's actually a Brahmin doesn't hoard money. He's not interested in keeping a whole stockpile of gold in his house. So that's the Brahmin. And then the Kshatriya, he makes his living by taxation. Taxation, or when they go out and conquer a kingdom, then they have some different things like that. And then a Vaishya, he makes his living, Krishna Gaurakshya Vanijan, Vaishya commerce from Bhavajan, by commerce, by cow protection, like that. And then a Shudra, he makes his living by working for the higher classes, and the higher classes don't give him money. Because if a Shudra gets money, guess what happens? Misused. He gets drunk. You know, some people think that's cruel, that it shouldn't give a Shudra money, but it's actually the best thing for them. Like, I mean, you wouldn't give a little kid who doesn't know how to use money, you wouldn't give him like $500. You know, a 6-year-old kid, all he hears is $500. I mean, maybe you give him $1 to buy a candy bar or something. But they'll buy the wrong thing. Like, if you give a kid money, even if you give a kid money, $1, $2, they'll buy candy that will actually be bad for their health. They're not going to, usually, unless they're really Krishna conscious, they're not going to put it in the hundi. The kids are going to actually do something bad. So Shudras were actually maintained just by giving, they give them clothes, you give them plenty of food, you give them a nice house and stuff like that. And of course, In the Western world, if you talk about that, they'll think that's really weird. You know, you're going to not pay anybody money. You're going to just give them a nice place. They're going to think it's slavery. But in the Vedic system, these Shudras were actually given much respect. Now, they were the musicians in society, the workers in society, like that. And even in Europe, you had this feudal society. I don't know if you ever heard about this. Feudal society means you had a lord and his manor, which means his estate. And then he would have different, what's called serfs. Anyone hear about this before? A serf was like the name for a Shudra in the European society hundreds of years ago. And he would take care of them like his family. He would, I mean, not every situation was ideal because people weren't dharmic. I mean, people were, it wasn't like the Indian culture. However, there was some sort of a expression or remnant of Vedic culture in those sorts of dealings. Hmm. So Varnashram is actually quite important. And it's also important insofar as engaging people according to their psychophysical nature. Just like one devotee was asking me last night, they're engaged in business. They said, I want to stop doing business as soon as possible. And I said, what will you do? And you can chant all day long. And they said, no. Can you read all day long? No. Can you do deity worship all day? I mean, I'm saying more things than I actually said. So I'm just making a point. I said, no. You want to be in charge of the government? No. And I said, well, it's better you continue doing your duty. And of course, that's Krishna's message to Arjuna, too, in the Gita. I mean, Arjuna, he wanted to become a sannyasi, basically. Renounce everything. Why? Because the duty that Krishna had given to him was painful. I mean, this duty that Krishna gave him was, as a kshatriya, was to basically kill his family members. I mean, can you imagine if Krishna said to you that your duty is fight with your family members and kill your guru too, you know. That your duty is to kill your guru. And that wouldn't be so nice, would it? But, you know, if Krishna said it, you'd have to do it. I'm not saying that you should just like dream up that Krishna is saying it, but Krishna, this is what I explain to people when people ask, you know, is Krishna conscious mean you fight? I said, the only time you fight is if Krishna directly tells you to fight. Or if there's some obvious thing, you're protecting something, someone, or someone's being kidnapped. Or, like the Vedic injunctions, you can kill someone who kidnaps your wife, you can kill someone who sets fire, you can kill someone who gives you poison. So, and even in Russia, the Bhagavad Gita was being accused as a terrorist text. And the devotees had to fight that. And, you know, sometimes for Dharma, there has to be fighting. I mean, what can you do? I mean, we don't want to fight, but sometimes there has to be fighting. So the point I was making, talking to different devotees, is that you really have to do something that engages your mind in Krishna's service. It has to be something according to your psychophysical nature. In fact, Prabhupada said, the guru, one of his duties is to engage the disciple according to their psychophysical nature. There you go. Because if you're not, then Prabhupada said an idle mind is the devil's workshop. So somebody will be very happy being on the altar all day long worshiping the deities. Somebody else will be very happy all day long doing business and giving the results to Krishna. That's the point. It's not that, like sometimes people have this materialistic understanding of karma yoga, and they think if you just do your karma, then you're doing karma yoga. Isn't it? That's a common misunderstanding. If you say, what is your dharma? Well, I'm a jewelry store owner. Well, are you giving any of the results to Krishna? No. No, not giving to Krishna. I'm giving to wife. Or to, you know, whatever. So, what makes it karma yoga is that yat karoshi yadishnashi yasya hoshi detasi yat yatapashashi kantiya tat purushwa madarpanam, that you're giving, whatever you do, whatever you offer, whatever you give away is done for Krishna. And it could be any activity, almost any activity. Of course, not being a butcher, something like that. But practically any of the activities you do can be engaged in Krishna's service. Whether it is administration, whether it is deity worship, whether it is business, or whether it is meaning of work for Krishna. And so we should find what is that service we can do for Krishna that will occupy our minds for our whole lives. Otherwise, we'll be in trouble. And even within, we were talking last night, even within a particular varna, there are also different things that people are attracted to or people are not attracted to. Okay? Thank you. Anyway. See, even such a Sai Baba comes to the temple. I always call them that. So yesterday I was also giving the example that I'm mostly inclined towards study and things like that. And I like other things, brahminical things like deity worship, but I couldn't do it all day long. I just couldn't. My mind wouldn't be absorbed. I mean, after two hours a day is about it. And then, because I have my deity worship I do every morning. But then I just want to read. I want to study. I want to research something. Because it's the mind. So Vaimana Krishna Padara Vindayo. That's the point. Somehow or other, keep your mind absorbed in Krishna. And absorbed in Krishna means things related to Krishna. Twadiyanam Samarchanam. Things that are connected with Krishna. And in the Bhagavad Gita it said, Brahmarpanam Brahmahavir Brahmagno Brahmano Hutam Brahmatena Gantavyam Brahma Karma Samadhino. That if you have this absorption, samadhi, in Brahma Karma, that means work for Krishna. Karma means, in this context, work. And Brahma means spiritual. So if your mind is absorbed in some work for Krishna that's dovetailed in Krishna's service, then that is actually samadhi, or absorption in Krishna. Brahmarpanam Brahma Havir. It's like the example, Havir or Havi, means the ghee that is put in the fire. Just like when you put ghee in the fire, the ghee becomes purified. Before you put it in the fire, it's just ordinary substance. I mean, nice substance, but it's ordinary substance. But when you put it in the fire, then the smoke, even the smoke of the fire, becomes very purifying. It's like I was hearing about the Putra Kameshti ceremony of Maharaj Dasharath. And it's described, one of the things he had to do as part of the ceremony, to get a son, was to smell the smoke of the fire. Now, normally smelling smoke of the fire is actually pretty obnoxious. You can get cancer. You wouldn't say that it's spiritual to smoke a cigarette, would you? It's actually very dangerous. And Prabhupada said the smoke of the sacred fire is purifying. The first fire sacrifice that Prabhupada did in America, the devotees had all the windows closed. And it was, well, the smoke was filling the room and everyone was coughing. And Prabhupada said, this smoke is purifying. Everyone was, Prabhupada said, you get purified by smelling that smoke. So in other words, when something is offered to Krishna, then that very same thing that might have been contaminating or unhealthy for you becomes healthy and spiritually enlivening for you. So the same thing with our work. When it's offered to Krishna, then it becomes something. It becomes a stepping stone on your path back to Godhead. So like the ladies, if they have children, if they devote themselves to their children and raise the children in Krishna consciousness, that's spiritual activity. And that's as good as doing the deity worship. People should understand that. It's as good as doing the deity worship. Like sometimes if there was one lady who asked Prabhupada, now I have a child, I can't do any more deity worship. And Prabhupada said, your deity worship is taking care of your child. That's your deity worship. So we have to understand, devotees have this immature understanding that only the sadhana and only the deity worship is spiritual, but our whole lives should be spiritualized like that, according to our psycho-physical nature. Very important point. Someone wrote me the other day, he said, how can I determine what my psycho-physical nature is? With little children, it's a little easier. You give them that ceremony, you know, where you let them choose between the different varnas, right? You have that ceremony here? Actually, to do it properly, most devotees don't do it right. They just put gold and Bhagavatam out. But to do it properly, you're supposed to put out Bhagavatam, put out a sword. Did you ever do that here with a sword? A sword, not a gun. You don't want to put a gun, that's not. Or a bow and arrow. You know, little kid picks up a gun. So you put a you put a sword there, you put some money, and you put some power tools. You know, power tools, you know what those are? Or a hammer or something like that, you know, like a power drill. Yeah. So, and then you see which one the kid picks. That's for a kid, it's really easy. And when the Pandavas, it's an interesting story, when the Pandavas are, were being tested by King Drupada, Arjuna had just won Draupadi, and King Drupada didn't know who had won Draupadi, or what their varna was. So he made a test. He put out these different things for the different varnas. And the Pandavas immediately went for the weapons, according to the Mahabharata. They picked up the weapons and they were examining them, you know, the bow and arrow, like that, and the swords. And so then he understood they were Kshatriyas. And then he understood that they were probably the Pandavas. And the Pandavas revealed that to him, that they were the Pandavas, because they were in hiding at that particular point. So it's usually pretty easy. It's not simply what you're attracted to. It's what you can do for many hours a day. That's how I answered it. Because basically, Prabhupada also said that we're of mixed caste, of unknown origin. In other words, we have different propensities. You know, sometimes we like to study. Sometimes we like to play with tools. Sometimes we like to look at our bank account. Sometimes we like to fight. Especially devotees here, they like to fight a lot. So, what does that say? Oh, yeah. Neophyte devotee, that's called neophyte. You understand? That means a new fight. They're always having new fights. I know that's not where the word comes from. I'm just making a funny play on the words. So isn't it? I mean, we do have mixed castes, really. I mean, we like to do different things at some times of the day, at different times of the day. But basically, I answered this devotee. He wrote me an email. So, how do you find out what is my actual varna? I said, what would you like to do 8 hours a day and not go crazy and get bored with? And be enthusiastic about. And I compared that to, I gave a class like this in Suva, to the GBC meetings. That I go to the GBC meetings, I mean, the first half hour is a little interesting, but after 8 hours, I just want to jump out the window. You know, and I gave the example that sometimes at the GBC meetings, and the devotees have seen me, that I try to hide my computer under the desk and read it while the meeting's going on. And the chairman, we have this rule with GBC meetings, you're not supposed to use computers without the permission of the chairman. So the chairman's looking around and he sends his spies around to see who's doing that. They actually send spies, you know, around the meeting. You know, computer, you're violating the rule. Like that. And then as soon as he goes away, you know, and I just hide it under my dhoti or something like that, you know. We figure out a way, or I take my. This is also a little computer, and just reading some Shastra or something. So then it's obviously not my varna to be an administrator, although I can know about administration. You know, Brahman can actually teach things. A Brahman can teach martial arts, like Drona. He was a Brahman. He was teaching martial arts. Of course, he lost his Brahminical status by associating and eating the food cooked in the kitchen of Duryodhana. That's a different thing. But a Brahmin can teach martial arts. A Brahmin can teach anything, almost. A Brahmin can teach cow protection. A Brahmin can teach how to build a building. A Brahmin can teach, you know, Shastra too. But you have to see what you can do for so many hours a day and still be enthusiastic when you're finished. That's the point. So that's the standard that I use for an adult. That what do you, can you do for 8 hours a day and just really feel honey bowl when you're finished? So one should function according to Dharma. It's just practical. And that way your mind will be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And then interactions between the varna are prescribed too. Like the Brahmana is definitely given respect. They're the natural spiritual masters of society. And then, of course, then you have the ashrams too. We just spoke about varnas briefly. The ashram means brahmachari, grahastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. I mean, what do you feel comfortable in? So you can, like, Prabhupada gave the example of Gajendra the elephant. Gajendra the elephant, there's a story in the 8th canto of Bhagavatam, was fighting a crocodile. And he was fighting the crocodile in the water. And because he was fighting the crocodile in the water, because the crocodile is the animal of the water, the crocodile was winning. Now, fortunately, Gajendra the elephant remembered the prayers from his previous life. He was King Indradunya, and he had actually offended a Brahmin. He got cursed to be an elephant. So he remembered the prayers, began to pray, and then Krishna saved him and cut off the part of the mouth of the crocodile. But the point Prabhupada made in his purport was that one has to be situated in such a way, in the proper varna, so one is able to execute Krishna consciousness throughout one's life, enthusiastic. A proper ashram, sorry. And not varna. Proper ashram. So Prabhupada said if one has some trouble being a brahmachari and renounce situation, if they can continue enthusiastically serving Krishna in the household order of life, then they should be householders. So one shouldn't think that in order to be Krishna conscious, they have to renounce everything. That was also the preaching that went on in the early days of the movement. I mean, all of us, basically, we made the mistake of preaching like that. We're giving so many heavy classes against household life. And we all did it. I mean, I had practically everybody I know preached very heavy about renunciation. And that's not really our philosophy. Or at least it's a misapplication of the philosophy to preach heavy like that, because it'll disturb people's spiritual lives. It'll disturb people's spiritual lives. Bhaktivinoda Thakura in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita states that everybody has different needs, you know, basic needs. And these needs should be fulfilled for someone to be steady in Krishna consciousness year after year. And if they're not fulfilled, I'll give you an example. I mean, everybody has a basic need to eat, food, nutrition. So if we don't give you adequate nutrition, you're not going to be able to hear Bhagavatam class. You're always going to be thinking of your hunger. Or if we don't give you air, that's a basic need, right? If we keep you from breathing, then how are you going to be able to be Krishna conscious? I mean, die, obviously. So in the same way, people have different emotional needs, physical needs, psychological needs. And these have to be addressed too, and that has to do with the ashram. You understand? It has to do with the ashram. It's where we want people to be steady year after year executing Krishna consciousness. And that goes back to the whole reason why Prabhupada wanted Varnashram, to keep the devotees steady. And then also, just one other point about Varnashram. Varnashram brings it with it many cultural things, like ways of dress, ways of interaction, and that actually stabilizes a society. When you have these different cultural items, you know, why do we wear dhotis? Because it reminds us of who we are, not because dhotis are spiritual. I mean, there's many people in India who wear dhotis who are just demons. I mean, maybe Ravana wore a dhoti too. I don't know what he wore. I don't remember. It's been so many years since I've seen Ravana. But in any case, these dhotis remind us. They're like Prabhupada said, a policeman's uniform. They remind us who we are. And they Prabhupada called the sikha a flag. You understand? He said it's a flag. He reminds us that dhotis should have sikhas. It's not that... there's no reason for not having a sikha. I mean, even if you have to have some hair to go to work, you just fold your sikha in during the work time into your hair. But these are signs of a Vaishnava. And even though these things won't get us back to Godhead, it's not just by wearing a sikha you're going to go back to Godhead. I wish it was so easy. Then we just shave everyone's head off and put a sikha on it. However, they do keep us stable within the cultural context. And they're necessary for people who are not on the highest level. If someone's on the highest level in devotional service, they can be an avaduta. An avaduta means, the word avaduta means like the wind. They don't have to follow any social rules or norms. Like Lord Nityananda was like that. He didn't follow social norms. Lord Nityananda would go into the house of Srivas Thakur, sit on the lap of Srivas Thakur's wife, Malini, and even though he was like 7 feet tall and an adult, you know, he was like 48 years old, or 40-something years old, he would drink her breast milk. I mean, here's a grown man. Can you imagine someone 7 feet tall sitting on a woman's... you know, that's an avaduta. He can do anything. And he doesn't have to worry about the social rules or regulations or anything like that. Lord Nityananda would throw prasadam in the house of a Dvaitacharya. He would joke with the Dvaitacharya, would say, here's your prasadam. And he said, I was hoping to break my fast today, but this is not even a morsel. And anyway, so many things went on by personalities like Lord Nityananda, who were above, or like Lord Rishabhadev, who we were reading about in Suva. Lord Rishabhadev did this Jata Yoga process. But we are not on that platform. We are not on the platform of being completely transcendental, completely avadutas. We are on the platform of Vaidhi Bhakti. So we follow the rules and regulations of Vaidhi Bhakti and also the rules and regulations of our varna and also ashram. And then we'll have a stable society. So, any questions or comments? Yeah.
What happens, how do we judge someone's varna or ashram if they're not stable in pain? It's like they can't do anything at all for a long period of time.
If they can't do anything for a long period of time, they're shudra. So therefore, they have to be under discipline. A disciplinary thing. Like a shudra, he's controlled with a stick or with threats like that. That if you don't do this, if you don't wake up at this time and go to work, you know, there's no food for you or whatever. I mean, so that's how someone is controlled like that. Because he's not self-motivated. Because according to the Gita, enthusiasm or determination, sorry, determination in the mode of ignorance which a shudra is in never goes beyond dreaming and procrastination. You understand? So if someone's in the mode of ignorance, they're dreaming, oh, I'm going to do so much work for Krishna. I had a dream last night, I chanted Hare Krishna. That's a shudra, you understand? So they're not motivated to do anything. One in the mode of passion is very much motivated. One in the mode of goodness is motivated. So you can tell by someone's motivation or determination. So a shudra, let's say you say, you know, someone's a shudra, if you just leave them alone, they'll just sleep all day and eat all day. It's a Kumbhakarna philosophy of life. Kumbhakarna? Sleep for 6 months. You all know Kumbhakarna? From the Ramayana. Sleep for 6 months, get up, roll over, eat a bunch of elephants. You know. Kumbhakarna was like that. When they had to wake him up, they had elephants jumping on his chest, playing horns in his ears, right? Liquor, you know, so he gets up. The first thing he does when he gets up is he drinks and he eats. That's a description in the Bhagavatam. I mean, in the Ramayana, so... So some people are just like Kumbhakarna. See, of course, they can't fight like Kumbhakarna. but they can eat and sleep like Kumbhakarna. So therefore, discipline. You know, get up. It's time for Mangalarti. Get up. Right now. Get up. Nobody sleeps. If you don't go to Mangalarti, you fast half the day. Okay, I'm going to Mangalarti. Arivo, arivo, arivo. And then, anyway, you have to have discipline. However, it's better in the temple not to fill people, not to fill the temple with shudras. Because then all day long you're having to discipline people. It becomes a headache. I mean, it's really difficult to manage a temple like that. Because I remember one time I was a temple commander, where was it, Chicago. And I was just running around all day long, you know, trying to keep people from falling asleep and keeping them engaged in Krishna service. Whereas if you have a temple with Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, they're all just doing their service. Everything, management becomes much easier at that particular point. So, is that it? Can you explain that?
Yeah. But I see many who are really active at different times as well.
Yeah.
Not really the magic of sleeping.
Yeah.
But they can't stick to any one thing for long.
Maybe they haven't, first of all, maybe they haven't found the right thing to stick to. Because it's not just the general varna, but it's a specific activity within the varna that they'd like to do. So it's important to find out what people like to do and engage them accordingly. So that may require some questioning or presenting different things. Would you like to do this? Would you like to do that? Like we often ask children, what do you want to be when you grow up? You ever ask children that? And some of them say sannyasi. Some of the girls say sannyasi. So in America, it's like that. I want to be a sannyasi. But it's interesting that, you know, sometimes you have these young girls, you say, what do you want to be? Do you want to get married when you get older? No, I'll never get married. So as soon as they turn 18, where's my husband? So, yeah, in certain cases, it may be finding what their particular activity is. In other cases, it may be that they're just shudras, that they have to really be disciplined under... Shudra means you have to threaten, basically. Threaten with... Not beating or anything like that. That's not what I'm talking. But they have to see what's going to happen if they don't do their work. Like many people know that unless they work, there won't be money. And unless there's money, there's no food. And if there's no food, they starve. So therefore, they go to work every day, right? I mean, that's a big thing. So that's a shooter's motivation, too. No money, no food. Although, as soon as a shudra gets money, a shudra has a hole in his pocket. You understand? A hole in the pocket. That means, I mean, you see certain people, like they get paid, and within one day, the money's gone. Isn't it certain? I mean, I've been told that there's certain types of people here in Fiji that they just don't hold on to money. It just goes, whoop. And then the next day they're asking for a loan from there. against the next payday. You ever see people do that?
Yes.
So that's shudra. Whereas a Brahmin, yes, will give charity away, but will also keep something for emergencies for his own self. Like we see when the six Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami took sannyas, they would divide up their money. They didn't just like give it all away. They kept something for emergencies, something for the family, and 50% for Krishna conscious activities. So there was some intelligence that they used money. But a shudra's no. Oh, if there's something to eat, let's go to the Hare Krishna restaurant and buy 10 gallons of ice cream. Isn't it? So we actually do better business in our restaurant with shudras than we do with Brahmins. Right? Because the shudra, you know, the satisfaction of the senses is most important. So, anyway, so that's how to engage people. There has to be some threat sometimes, not heavy. I mean, just or otherwise you have to keep dealing with with people all the time, you know, you better do this, why should you do this? I mean, I've been temple president, temple whatever, many times, and it's a very difficult job. Because it's not my nature to threaten people. I'm more of a brahminical nature, so what happened when I was a temple commander, I ended up doing everything myself. Because it was just, I just didn't have the nature to chastise people. I mean, some people have that nature. I just can't do it, you know, just it's too painful for me to chastise people. So therefore, all right, I'll do it myself. I'll do the RT, I'll do all the cooking. So I'm not a very effective temple president for that reason. I'm terrible at it. Because it's just not in me to threaten or chastise people. It should have some sort of kshatriya nature to do that, isn't it? It has to be. I mean, a Brahmin can do it, but he has to have a little bit of a kshatriya nature. But I don't, my kshatriya nature just like disappeared after I started chanting Hare Krishna. When I first joined the movement, I was thinking, boy, it would be really nice to be in charge. But then after I chanted a little more Hare Krishna, it was just, that's it. No more. So now even the GBC service is just like, it's an austerity. It's an austerity I do for Prabhupada. But it's not something that I would really pick as my nature. I'd much rather be giving class, studying, and research, things like that. It's fun. For me, that's fun. I mean, you could put me by the computer or doing the research all day long, and I'll be in ecstasy. You know, reading or taking notes on Prabhupada's books. I mean, it's just like ecstatic. I become happy when I hear about it. But if you put me behind a desk all day long, you know, or doing the accounting, you're using spreadsheet, you know what a spreadsheet is? Accounting, writing numbers down. I know how to do it, but it's torture. Yes.
Would you agree with this sentiment of mine that temple leaders or presidents should be engaged in some level of devotion?
That's a political question. They can guide the deity worship. I mean, I used to do a lot of deity worship myself. And Prabhupada said also dancing in front of the deities is deity worship. Dancing and chanting.
Before then, many times, things may be missed out. One may not be knowledgeable about things.
Well, they should be aware, yeah. Temple president should know, and guru, temple president, and leader should know about every aspect and keep an eye on everything, yeah. Yeah, they should definitely know. Like, you know, like I know about cooking, deity worship, construction, electrical things. So yesterday we were going around looking at all the things that had to be done in the temple. You know, I know about that. Prabhupada said devotee's expert, yeah. So the devotee has to be aware, a devotee should know. Obviously, Prabhupada did say we shouldn't be so much specialists. The leaders should be able to do everything. That's brahminical, actually. The leaders should be able to do everything. Deity worship, give a class, go to the bank. And I can definitely do all those things. But there are certain things I wouldn't want to do all day long. Like accounting. You can imagine, I mean, for me, it's just like, for someone to be an accountant is like going to jail. Sitting in a computer just entering numbers and manipulating numbers. But you have other devotees like Madhurang, who's in ecstasy. You know Madhurang? Is it? He sits there, you know, counting, manipulating numbers all day long, and there's a big smile on his face. And for me, you know, it would be the biggest punishment. Like, you know, if the army didn't like me here, they'd send me to do accounting. I'd rather run around the army grounds than do accounting. But other people like it. And so everybody's different nature, isn't it? Or Gokul is dealing with people's Vodafone accounts all day long. It drives me crazy, you know. People want, where's my credit? right? Where's my bonus? And I would say, you know, if I was doing his job, I would say, just chant Hare Krishna and cool. Cool it. You're not that body. So there has to be practical things, yeah.
Before, I was not coming to Mangalarati.
Yeah.
So much pain in my body. When I start coming to Mangalarati, how the pains went.
That's good.
How the pains went away.
Yeah, Krishna was pleased with you and he took away the pain. And that we come to Mangalarati because we want to please Krishna. That's bhakti. It pleases Krishna. We dance for the deities to please Krishna. We chant to please Krishna. It's all bhakti. But, you know, sometimes there has to be a little force. I remember when I was temple commander, I had to force people to go to Mangalarati. Even I would take, they would be sleeping in their sleeping bags. I'd drag the sleeping bag into the shower and turn the shower on. Did you ever see stuff like that? In the early days, you must have seen stuff like that. No.
Not here.
Not here.
No one had to go to that
extreme. Really? But I had to go to that extreme. I didn't like to do it. But I, you know, just turn the water on and all of a sudden they're in the bed. And the cold water is coming out. In the early days, too, we didn't have any hot water. And in America, sometimes in New York, it was like below zero. And you turn on the water, it's like needles coming and hitting you before Mangalarati. It's like needles hitting your body. It's really intense. And so, but, you know, we made the devotees get up. But a Brahmin will get up automatically. I mean, like, Gokul will tell you that I get up automatically in the morning. I don't even need an alarm. I just get up, you know, 3:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm up. And I chant. And if I'm tired, I'll take a little nap the rest of it after the Brahma Muhurta hour. As Prabhupada said, Brahma Muhurta hour, no one should rest during the Brahma Muhurta hour. I don't know if any of you rest during the Brahma Muhurta hour, you probably experience the strangest, weirdest dreams. Isn't it? I mean, it's because Lord Shiva's out. Did you know that? Lord Shiva comes out during the early morning hours, the twilight hours, and he's going around with all of his associates, the pisachas, the bhutas, the pretas, the ghosts, the witches, and they try to take over your consciousness when you're sleeping. So no one can sleep during Brahma Muhurta hour. Anyway, so any other questions or comments? Questions, comments, arguments, problems? No? Just a little talk about Varnashram. Of course, Varnashram also requires a farm community, too. Prabhupada said that. Farm community, because it's based on agriculture. You have the Baishas, who are the stomach of society. They must do agriculture. And here in Fiji, we don't have any farm communities. In America, I don't think we have any farm communities either. We have people, we have devotees who live in the country, but they don't have, farm community means they're growing their own food. Like we have a lot of devotees who live in the country. Like, should I mention any places? Anyway, we have big rural communities, but a farm community means simple living, high thinking, where they're using the oxen to plow the fields and growing their own grains and things like that. And that's not really happening in America. Because people are very lazy. I've tried to start some farm communities in America, and I've been unable to do it because the devotees just wouldn't work. Even in our the temple, we have some gardens and everything like that. We grow flowers, but the devotees prefer to buy flowers rather than to pick the flowers that are growing. It's amazing. America's like that, you know. There'll be flowers growing. Even here in Fiji, I gave that example that one time I was in Tabayuni and the plane was late and there was no breakfast. And the devotees said, the supermarkets are closed. It was Sunday. And they said, we can't give you breakfast. And I said, what is that tree over there? And they said, that's a banana tree. And I said, what grows on a banana tree? And they said, bananas. And what do you do with bananas? Oh, you eat them. Okay, so go to that tree and get some bananas. Really? We've never done that before. And that's Kaviyuni too, you know. And I said, what's that other tree? Oh, that's a papaya tree. What grows on the papaya tree? Papayas. So get me a papaya. And then I said, that tree has nuts in it. Oh, get some nuts from the tree. So we had a big feast for breakfast. And it was very nice. Natural Fiji-grown feast instead of supermarket-grown. People think food comes from the supermarket, right? If you ask someone, you know, where does food come from? Oh, supermarket. They were making that propaganda in McDonald's that hamburgers grow on hamburger trees. Because people don't have that connection between things, isn't it? So anyway, that's what Varnashram also means, to grow things. You have a natural life like that. So, time to end. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. And tonight we'll have a program at Pandu's house.